Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone, and welcome to The Presumption. I'm Sarah, and I'm here with my esteemed partner in crime, Jim Griffin.
Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Jim, and Matt Fondelier, our wonderful producer. Hey, Matt.
Hey, hey.
So today it's just us, which is always really fun, and it's always extra fun when Jim shares these stories that he just sort of drops like random. Like, you know, we had his daughter on not too long ago, Hope, and suddenly just very casually it came up that, like, you know, Jim was involved in the aftermath of James Brown's death in some way. And I'm like, wait a second. It dawned on me that I just recently did this episode of Death by Fame, which is a show on Investigation Discovery. And I'm, you know, honored to be the legal host of the show and the ambassador of the show. And we did a whole episode on James Brown that's going to air this season, focused on more about his death. We don't know if it's a murder or not, but his son-in-law's murder. And the idea was, you know, we went into a lot about his wealth, people that wanted a piece of his estate. And so it turns out that Jim was very much connected to the estate in the capacity of an attorney. And so that's what the conversation is going to be about today.
If I may, I just wanted to jump in and just say congratulations to you, by the way, for making it to season two of Death by Fame. And for people who aren't already regularly watching the show, it airs Monday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central on Investigation Discovery. And it also streams on Discovery Plus. So I guess just to start, I'm curious from you guys, you know, or really from you, Sarah, first, you know, what is James Brown's connection to this show? And as we start to dive into these conspiracies, I know, Jim, you represented several of the, I'm guessing, many children. I don't want to jump to conclusions here, but I get the feeling, you know, got the rock star vibes going. Sarah, can you maybe kick it off here and explain a little bit more about what's going on?
Yeah, so just generally about Death by Fame, you know, it actually is a very interesting show that focuses on how Hollywood is not glitz and glamour, that there's this dark, sinister side to Hollywood, and that people come here, my town, thinking that they're going to make it big, but then they end up with addiction, affliction, dangers, and even death that comes with fame. So it's the dark side of fame. And why James Brown fit into this season was, you know, we always talk about, we don't need motive for murder or any crime. But money is often a motive for crime, specifically murder. And so there's all these questions around how James Brown died. Was it really of congestive heart failure this Christmas of 2002, I think, or 2006, I'm sorry, 2006. Or was it a plot to kill him? There was a witness in the hospital, which we'll get into, etc. So James Brown is one of many interesting episodes. There's one about Jam Master Jay, Run DMC's DJ, and a whole slew of other stories, 8 episodes. So I want to toss it over to Jim, to your point, Matt. You represented the estate against claimants, but apparently it was like 2 of his biological daughters. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the estate.
Yeah, so not I did not represent the estate, sir. Oh, I represented 2 of his daughters that were born out of wedlock, and one was named LaRonda Pettit. She was out of Houston, and the other was Nicole Parrish, who's a Canadian citizen, lived in Vancouver. And when James Brown died, his managers knew that there was going to be a big fight over his estate, because what he left everything except for his personal belongings and the house to a trust. And it was called the James Brown Feelgood Trust. And the beneficiaries of the trust were underprivileged kids, South Carolina and Georgia, for scholarships, higher education. James Brown believed that education was the way out of poverty. He didn't have a higher education. He was extremely talented and hardest working man in show business. And he provided the children that, you know, he lived with education opportunities. And he thought that was enough. And so, you know, what wealth he had was going to be passed to this charitable trust to give out scholarships. And that was going to be, you know, challenged. He had had a wife that had married afterwards, and there was some issues. Was it a legitimate marriage? Her name was Tammy Ray, and Tammy had been married to you know, a foreign national, whether it was an arranged marriage so he could get U.S. citizenship, but it was kind of weird, and that was never annulled. And then they had a child, but anyway, during all that, people knew that there were other children out there, and without a doubt, and people were going to come forward and say, James Brown's my daddy. And so what they did was they got a pathologist who actually turns out to be, the wife of a federal judge. And they harvested, some tissue from his thigh, and the federal judge and his wife drove that tissue to a lab corps in North Carolina to maintain the chain of custody. And so that anyone who claimed that they were a child of James Brown would take a DNA test, send it to lab corps, and they would test it against his DNA. And, you know, was he your daddy? And so these 2 women, LaRonda approached me first, and then Nicole came afterwards. They both had positive DNA test. And so, to the extent that there were benefits coming out of the whole estate fight, you know, we wanted them to share in those benefits. And so, you know, we filed a claim against the estate saying, you know, we were children of James Brown. We were not named in the will. We don't know whether he knew we were his children or not. And so if the will is going to get busted, then, you know, we're entitled to a part of it. And that was my involvement. What was really interesting, I had, I'd filed that paperwork, Sarah and Matt, in probate court in Aiken County, South Carolina, which is where he died. He lived in a small, really small community called Beach Island, but he had the biggest house in Beach Island, but it was in South Carolina. Augusta, Georgia was his home. And so I come back to Columbia from Washington, D.C., where I had just pled a guy guilty for campaign finance violations involving national and federal campaigns. And, I mean, it was a big deal, and we were trying to keep it quiet. And I showed up at my office and flew in from the airport, and my secretary says, the BBC's on the phone for you. And I go, Holy God, that didn't take long. And I'm thinking the BBC's calling about this campaign finance plea that I just did. And no, they're calling about James Brown and my client, LaRonda Pettit. And it just went from there. That was the hottest story at the time about James Brown's estate and I can tell you a little bit about more about LaRonda and Nicole if you want to hear it. But
yeah, and it's in a minute. I have a question though, a couple questions. There were two of his daughters that this came up in my research for the show that had fought to be the representatives of his estate. Those were not the two that you represented, right?
No, they okay. were not. Those were two that he had claimed, and you know,
right. But he'd also, you know, it was interesting for me to find out also that what you said about him leaving, I think like 50% of his estate or wealth to this Feel Good. What was it? The Feel Good.
The James Brown I Feel Good Trust.
Yeah.
It was more than that. And I mean, it was everything except his personal belongings and memorabilia. Right. And so what is that worth? Who knows? And so there's a question what the estate was worth. And I got to tell you, when he died, it wasn't worth much because, I mean, as you know, artists,
yeah,
and particularly musicians, I mean, they sell their catalog of copyrighted work. And that's where they get, and they sell that. And then they spend that. And, you know, they make their money, you know, doing concerts. And James Brown, and you know, he was doing shows up until he died. I mean, that's how he made money, and he was spending it as fast as he was getting it. What the wealth of his estate turns out to be is something called reversionary rights under the federal copyright statute. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, an artist cannot permanently convey their interest in their copyrighted works. It's only good for so many years, and after those years pass, I couldn't tell you whether it reverts back to the artist or to his beneficiaries. And so that is where the wealth is. And then the estate beneficiaries can then market those copyright materials and sell them again. And so there was wild fluctuations on how much his estate was worth, whether it was worth, you know, $1 million, $3 million or $100 million.
I got $100 million, which sounded like crazy, but also, you know, what that doesn't take into account, aside from what you just said, Jim, is that a lot of artists, including James Brown, often get taken advantage of by their representatives, by their money people, by their entertainment lawyers. All these people want a piece of the person. And one of the things the show highlights is that James Brown sort of wanted to get out of the South, felt like he's enslaved to these people, and wanted to move to New York. And a lot of it had to do with his lawyer, and I think an accountant, who somehow ended up with a deal that they're supposed to get like 50% of his estate. I don't know if that ended up happening or not.
They were removed, but the two individuals, one was a lawyer, one was his financial advisor, the trust was set up and they were the trustees of the trust. So they would control all the money and get management fees from that. And that's and so that was sort of the undue influence claim. Here's a quick side note. The lawyer who did this estate plan for James Brown is serving time in prison for murder. He's doing 30 years because he got drunk one night when his wife was out of town, went to a strip club, took his clothes off. He got kicked out of the strip club, drives through the parking lot, shoots through the door and kills a guy. And he was a prominent lawyer in South Carolina. And now he is doing 30 years in prison.
And that's his lawyer?
That was James Brown's lawyer who did the estate.
My God.
He does know at the strip club, you're not supposed to take your clothes off, right?
Right. Well, you're supposed to watch other people take their clothes off.
I think Chris Rock says there's only champagne in the champagne room, and that's all you get.
But that's hilarious. And one of them, I think maybe the accountant, I don't know, but they did time on having embezzled some of the money as well. Yeah. So there's a lot of shade around that. And then back to the people that were blowing up your phone, claiming to be James Brown's offspring. I mean, he had said at some point, my children aren't getting shit, essentially, in so many words, right. Like they're not getting shit. This is where my money's going. And so then all these people are coming out. I mean, Hope was saying, like, she was at your office, interning that summer, and your phone was being blown up by people saying that they're his kids. I'm really interested about this one woman who apparently called the Dr. Phil show offering to take a DNA test to prove she's Brown's daughter. And then she even came to you with a show idea that she wanted to get involved. What was that about?
So Dr. Phil show called me one day wanting to invite LaRonda Pettit on the show to talk about, you know, what it's like being growing up with a celebrity dad. And she knew James Brown was her dad. I mean, and so did Nicole, but you know, LaRonda had met James Brown a number of times. LaRonda's mother worked for James Brown and it was sort of like, you know, would take care of him, take care of his wardrobe and stuff. And everyone knew that LaRonda was a child of James Brown. No one knew much about Nicole, but anyway, and LaRonda was a big personality, looked just like James Brown. And so whenever they would do shows or interviews, I mean, LaRonda would always be photographed because she looked so much like him. And so Dr. Phil calls one day, his showrunner does, and wants LaRonda to come on, and LaRonda would be happy to go on, but she wanted money, and Dr. Phil's show, they weren't about paying money. So that ended that, but the, her show idea though was that she was interviewed in Rolling Stone magazine and she was trying to pitch a show. It was like that modeled after Survivor, and she was called it DNA Island, and where all the people who claimed that they were offsprings of James Brown would go on an island, isolated island somewhere, and everyone would take a DNA test, and each week, you know, you'd get the results from somebody, and then if they weren't DNA positive, then they'd get kicked off the island. She called it DNA Island, and
that could be DeFusky, no?
But anyway, so yeah, and so just briefly about Nicole, she's a wonderful person. She's a Canadian citizen, and it was really important for her to establish paternity so that her children would be U.S. citizens, and she would be a U.S. citizen because that had never been established. And that's really what we tried to do for her, and we were able to accomplish that. But Nicole's mother was a beautiful Caucasian woman living in Vancouver, and James Brown did a concert up there, and she met him backstage, and then next thing you know, she's on a plane with James Brown traveling around the United States, and then he kicked her out about somewhere around San Antonio, and she makes her way back to Vancouver, and she's pregnant, and she has James Brown's child, and there was some litigation. He paid some money, maybe, you know, $25,000, $50,000 back then. But Nicole was a wonderful person, great voice. She was an aspiring singer. But her day job, she was a federal probation officer.
Wow.
Really, really first class.
The talent. And you know, James Brown, I meant to say this early on, it really, I mean, when you think about it, he's beyond a legend because generation after generation borrows from his music. I mean, you know, forget Michael Jackson. There's Usher, there's Bruno Mars. Like, you know, I learned so much through researching for this show, how much he has influenced music that is, you know, from today. He was a whole other level.
He died, you know, on Christmas Day. A big thing that he would do would be hand out turkeys for Christmas. And I remember that, you know, him dying, learning about it, but he was handing out turkeys. It was cold, rainy. I think it was around Atlanta. And then he came down with, you know, the flu or pneumonia and he died of congestive heart failure, you know, and very quickly, very quickly. Now, he wasn't a healthy guy and
I want to jump in if I may, Sarah, because I'm just curious where the conspiracy theory is coming in here, because everything you're saying, Jim, I feel like has a big alleged in front of it. An alleged heart attack happened a little too quickly. What's the conspiracy? Like, have you even heard of a conspiracy? I had no idea.
Yeah, I didn't either, but I can't dismiss it. And I'm very curious if Jim hears me out, what he thinks is that – you know, for years, I mean, I'm like Jim. I thought, yeah, he died in a hospital room, congestive heart failure. But as it turns out, his family doctor believed that he's going to make it out of the hospital. Like, he was on the meds. And a nurse at some point had said that she saw two men walking. She basically caught them leaving the hospital room, his hospital room. But that they had come in when nobody else was there with Brown. And she found it very suspicious. And they believe that somebody overdosed him through his IV. It might sound far-fetched, but the interesting thing is Yama, his biological daughter, who stood to gain, I don't know, $3.8 million or whatever, she refused an autopsy. So there was no autopsy done. And then, you know, there were all these people, like we just talked about, and Jim was saying, who wanted a piece of James Brown, you know, his wealth. And so we've got, you know, money's always a motive. Yama's kind of doing this weird thing with the autopsy. The nurse is saying she saw two men just before he was pronounced dead. The doctor's saying he was totally on the mends. He was supposed to get out. So the person at the helm of this conspiracy theory that Brown was murdered and not, you know, did not die by natural cause was Yama's ex-husband, Darren Lumar. And he's kind of a shady character. Like, you know, he's gone through life claiming to be this, I don't know, successful, wealthy guy. And everyone thinks that's who he is. But behind all of that, he had a lot. He like swindled, you know, a pastor out of like $140,000. Like, he was just shady. And he had his own set of problems. And there was domestic violence with Yama, which led to a divorce. And so there's multiple conspiracy theories. There's the conspiracy theory.
Sarah, he's the guy, though, that was the one kind of always saying that there's no way James Brown died of a heart attack, right?
Exactly. Like,
he's running his mouth everywhere.
Exactly. And shortly after James Brown died, whatever you think killed him, Lumar in Atlanta drives into his garage and is shot down and dies. And there's physical evidence, there's DNA, all that stuff in the garage. There's witnesses, the neighbors that, you know, identify the car and, you know, what the person looked like, whatnot. All this is in the episode, so you got to watch. And then it's like, okay, well, wait a second. Was it someone who was after Lumar and had nothing to do with Brown? Or is this someone, because of the conspiracy theory that Lumar was spreading about Brown getting murdered, may have been after Lumar? We don't know. And that's really kind of the point of these episodes, is that they leave the true crime fan with sort of this, you know, all the questions, right? It's more questions than answers. And that's the whole fascination. But what do you think, Jim? I mean, you really think that for sure, no autopsy, and you're saying, yeah, he died of
what you're saying, I did hear through as LaRonda kind of became united with the family. I mean, that was being said, but you know, I didn't really give it much credence. And normally a coroner would do an autopsy if the coroner believes there's suspicious circumstances around the death and it wasn't just death by natural causes. But when the coroner doesn't, you know, request an autopsy, the family is given that option. But I can tell you there are cultural preferences, particularly in the South, about an autopsy. I mean, not many families want to have their loved ones desecrated on an autopsy table. I mean, autopsy is, I mean,
it's invasive.
Really strip the body and dig in and out and take the head off and then sew it back up and put it in a casket. And then, you know, African-American funerals are homecoming events and they go on for days and they have open caskets and they gather around the casket. So the fact that Yama didn't ask for an autopsy doesn't really concern me at all. I mean, I've been to some beautiful homecoming funerals where, you know, everyone's around the casket and it's always an open casket, everyone I've been to. So I don't know how you have an open casket after an autopsy, but maybe there's a way.
No, that is a, see, I'm so glad we're having this discussion with you. Because it brings another perspective to this that I made the point on the show that a lot of people refuse autopsy because it's invasive, you know, but you bring this perspective of being in the South and having gone to African American funerals. This is a whole thing that I mean, I've never been to one. Sounds really glorious.
I mean, it's a celebration, and it's sad, yeah. But it's a celebration, and they go on for hours.
Yeah,
I
mean, yeah, and that just that brings a whole other perspective to the idea why people, for innocuous reasons, refuse autopsies. So, if you're not buying into Brown being murdered as opposed to dying of congestive heart failure, then there's no second part to this. Where do you think that his murder was related to Lumar? I mean, Lumar was definitely murdered, but you know, there's always been this question of are the two deaths related or not? Because they happened so quickly, one after another.
Other than the proximity of the two deaths occurring so quickly together, and the fact that this Lumar guy was constantly talking about a possible conspiracy, mm-hmm. were there any other pieces of evidence or indicators that these could be connected, or is it really just kind of those two things?
Just those two things, and the fact that, you know, he was divorced from Yama. Yama wanted a piece of the estate. You know, so it was like, was he doing this to throw Yama under the bus that she's behind a hit job on her dad? I mean, you know, there was all that. But in terms of, you know, not aside from refusing the autopsy, the theory that Brown died, was killed as opposed to, or overdosed as opposed to die of natural cause, it's really that nurse that kind of raised a red flag. Who are these guys? Like, this is James Brown in the hospital. You don't just like walk in and out of his room. Why were they there? And, you know, and because putting that together with the family lawyer, I mean, with the family doctor who's saying, you know, he's doing well, but you know, my dad died of a heart attack and he was on the mends in the hospital and everyone thought he was getting out that Monday, and that Sunday he had a reoccurrence and died. So, you know, Joe McCullough, who was on our show, had a heart attack this week. He's doing fine, but you know, it's a fleeting situation that can change. So the doctor can say, oh, you're getting out, you're doing fine, and then something could happen. But there is this, you know, the episode is definitely fascinating and it's focused on this. So I want to.
I will agree. I mean, that James Brown's condition was not deathly up until he died. I mean, he was in the hospital with pneumonia, and then next thing you know, reports are James Brown died, and it was, you know, I mean, it shook the South, shook the music industry. I mean, he was bigger than life for sure.
Do you know if the money that he had set aside for that I Feel Good trust that actually went to that?
It is now that's, oh gosh, that estate litigation is still going on. A real interesting development early on. So you had the heirs, Yama, her brothers and sisters, and then you had his current wife Tammy, and then her son, and they're all attacking the estate plan. They're saying that it was a result of undue influence because these managers now have control over this trust. And believe it or not, the state of South Carolina comes in, and for charitable trusts, they stand in the shoes. Now they represent the trust for the benefit of, you know, the charities. And so Alan Wilson's office, the Attorney General of South Carolina, handled that end of it. And there were a lot of lawyers, a lot of parties. And after about a year or so, they all got together and they reached a settlement. And the settlement essentially was the family members, and the wife, and they would all get more than what James Brown intended to leave them. The trust would get less than what James Brown intended to leave it. But then instead of the managers, the Attorney General's office would be in control of the trust. And the former trustees appealed that to the South Carolina Supreme Court. And in really a very scathing opinion, the Supreme Court said that James Brown was of sound mind when he made this estate plan. It wasn't up to the state or any of these proposed beneficiaries to upset it based on, you know, they just didn't like it. And they said that the state overstepped their bounds in negotiating the settlement. And So the Supreme Court threw out the settlement and said, you've got to honor James Brown's wishes. And so, to my knowledge, to this day, it is being funded. It's being funded with these copyright, valuable copyright reversionary interest, and that kids are getting scholarships.
How long did this litigation
last? Sarah, I still get notices from the court. I mean, the case isn't closed. I still get notices because there was a special administrator appointed, and you know, the special administrator is still spending money and having to file things with the court. So, I mean, you know, it's still going on, And in the meantime, you know, LaRonda Pettit died, unfortunately, probably a couple of years into it. So she passed away, but but her daughter was a grandchild who qualified for scholarship money. That's another thing. It was interesting. James Brown left scholarship money to his grandchildren, who had not gotten to higher education age, but not to his children, who he had provided education opportunities. And, you know, believe it or not, I mean, James Brown valued education. I mean, because he didn't have an education, and he thought that was the way out, and he wanted to have as many kids as, you know, opportunity to get an education as possible. And that's
what I also feel like he had, I mean, obviously he had talent, which was a gift, but I also think that he was, you know, he didn't want to just give free money to his kids. He wanted to be able to, you know, put it to a good cause. You know, you don't get to just live off of daddy because daddy made money. You know, I also got that sense from him, but I want to leave with this. You guys, your favorite James Brown song, I'm going to start with Matt.
Ooh. Okay, well, let's see. Mine's actually kind of a two-part answer, because I'll say the first, like, knowledge of James Brown was not the song Living in America, but the Weird Al version, Living with a Hernia, which I loved as an eight-year-old. And that was, I was like, oh, wait, Weird Al makes songs that are real songs? So I think that was the first actual James Brown song I heard, was the real version of that song. But my go-to favorite is Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. It's just one of those songs that makes me happy every time. I know it's kind of like a pedestrian answer, but the horn section is just, it just gets me every time. So that's my personal favorite. Jim, what about you?
I mean, obviously it's I Feel Good. And that title is I Got You, I Feel Good. I mean, you know, it's no better song than that in my book.
Can you sing it?
Sure. No, I can't. I do not.
One thing I can't do is sing.
That's
for sure. I know, me neither.
Sarah, how about you?
My favorite is America is My Home. It's a spoken song, one that most people don't really haven't heard or don't know about, but it resonates with me because of the lyrics, because I'm an immigrant. And he talks about, even when America is so divisive, it is still the best country in the world. And he sort of, I think he ends the song with like, name me any other country. You can start out as a shoeshine boy, which he was, and then end up shaking hands with the president. And I just think that it's so perfect for the times right now, right? We're living in such a divisive, you know, time politically and in all ways. And he was such a great figure of the civil rights era. Besides his talent. And it just resonates with me because, you know, my family came here because it was the land of opportunity, you know, and I mean, we still had to work our ass off, but we didn't have the talent that James Brown has, but America the Great, you know? And so America is My Home is my favorite song. So I think
let me give a plug to that. They did a Chadwick Boseman, who is from Anderson, South Carolina, who passed away early. Also is a great actor, but he played James Brown in a movie about the James Brown's life. I couldn't tell you the name of it top of my head, but he played a great James Brown, and it's a great movie. And I would recommend it to anyone who's listening to this.
What's it called?
I'll pull it up here, but Chad Boseman played James Brown, and it was
Get On Up.
Get On Up. Yep. It was a great movie.
Right now. Yeah. Great movie. About that one.
It's awesome. So good.
It's like, I feel like James Brown is a, and he is on my playlist, but Sunday morning kind of jam, you know, like,
oh yeah,
it's kind of like moving around the house, getting your coffee on, chilling, you know. Anyway, Jim,
get on up. Yeah, watch it if you're interested in James Brown. It's a great story about his life growing up, how, what the conditions were. You know, his dad left him, his mom, you know, was alcoholic and didn't care for him much, and then she would show up at times during his career and he would give her money, but you know, it was, he had a rough childhood, but he was very, and he had a family that took him in. He like a lot of entertainers, learned to sing and in the gospel choirs and got his start there, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
story.
It's a fascinating story. So Jim, this was such a great conversation because you kind of, you know, I don't know, everyone's come to know you as Alec Murdoch's attorney, and it's like there's so much more to you, and you're just not, you know, it's funny because I bring up stuff to Matt, I bring up stuff to Joe, I'm like, oh, you know, this thing, and he'll be like, oh, that was not a big deal, I just was like doing this with this case, and it was like not, and I'm like, wait, what? You know, and this is kind of that kind of situation. It's like James Brown's estate is not just any other estate. And it was so tied in with the story that Investigation Discovery is featuring in the season. And yet, you know, the perspective that you brought to what the episode highlights is very different. And I think that our viewers, our listeners, and those of Investigation Discovery are going to really appreciate it. So I thank you, my partner in crime, for sharing your experience here.
Yeah, I want to jump on and add to that, if I may, which is to say that we're always bringing a real perspective when it comes to this podcast, The Presumption. So if you're listening to this for the very first time, you're a true crime fan, and you want to hear about real cases from real veteran lawyers and actually really hear about how the work is actually done, I personally, I'm not a lawyer. I have learned so much just from listening to you two over the last, you know, 30 plus episodes that we've released. So again, if this is your first time listening, please subscribe to our podcast. We're called The Presumption, and at The Presumption is our handle on all the social media pages, including YouTube as well, youtube.com/@The Presumption. You can go there and watch the conversations, including this one that we've just finished up taping. So anyway, just want to throw that out. Great job, Sarah and Jim, as always. And,
thank you, Matt and Jim, until next week.
I feel good.
Oh, it's okay for this episode. I feel good too, but we rest.
We rest.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.